Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Catherine Richard, filling in for Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. This hour, the difficulties Black women face navigating the healthcare system. For many people, the American healthcare system can be overwhelming. Where to go, how to pay, who to see. But it's especially difficult for African American women. They're more likely to develop diabetes, high blood pressure, and Alzheimer's, and they're more likely to face discrimination when they're trying to get care. And here's an astounding statistic. African American women are 3 to 4 times more likely to die or almost die from pregnancy or childbirth-related causes than white women, and that's across all income levels. So today, I want to tease apart this extraordinarily complex issue. Why is the healthcare system failing Black women? Is this an access issue? Do we need more African American doctors in our hospitals? And why isn't that happening either? As our guests join us, I want to hear from you. What have your experiences been like as a Black woman seeking healthcare? What barriers did you encounter and how did you cope with them? And what do you think needs to change? You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or tweet your experiences to me at Kat Richert. That's C-A-T-R-I-C-H-E-R-T. Our first guest is Rachel Hardiman. She's an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. Welcome, Rachel.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Our second guest is Dr. Lisa Cooper. She is a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Welcome, Lisa.
Good morning.
So I want to start by reading a short excerpt from a piece I read by a writer named Erica Stalling. She's Black, and she described her recovery from a double mastectomy like this. The walk from my bed to the bathroom felt like a marathon. I asked my mother to call a friend who could accompany us home in case we needed help getting up the stairs to my second floor apartment. A nurse who overheard the conversation, a white woman, said, You didn't have surgery on your legs. I don't understand why you would need assistance. And the writer goes on to say that she was ignored when she complained about various symptoms associated with her recovery, which turned out to be real issues when she was able to get the surgeon back in her room. So, Rachel, I want to start with you. Does this sound like a normal experience for a Black woman in the healthcare system? The author said, you know, I'm not sure if these racial aggressions were, you know, motivated by race. They were subtle. But I'm wondering if that's typically the case, or are Black women experiencing even more overt racism? What does this look like?
I think it's both, right? So, you know, there's these subtle kind of racial microaggressions that women are talking about and experiencing where it's like, I'm not quite sure what that was about, but it doesn't quite feel right. And then there's the more overt stories that we've heard, you know, with the stories of people like Serena Williams and her experience after giving birth to her, you know, her little girl. And so there's this long kind of spectrum of experiences of discrimination that that women of color and Black women in particular are experiencing throughout their, you know, their time accessing healthcare or, you know, in recovery after a surgery, such as the story you just shared.
Yeah, Lisa, I want to throw that out to you. Does that story sound familiar to you in your experience and research?
Unfortunately, it does. You know, I would have to agree with Rachel that, you know, this is just something, this is a story that I hear over and over again. I've seen it as a physician. I've actually seen patients being treated differentially based on race, and then I've also experienced it, you know, being a patient and being a family member, you know, that accompanies my family member. So, you know, like it's been said before, sometimes it's something fairly subtle where, you know, you're not really sure whether you can attribute it to someone just having a bad day or just, you know, being rude, or whether it's truly due to race.
Yeah. So, Rachel, why is it that Black women are more likely to have certain health troubles like diabetes, obesity, that sort of thing?
So that's a huge question, right? And I think, you know, the the reasons are multifactorial. They're complex. It's what there's a lot of folks like myself and Dr. Cooper out there who are doing this work and really digging into the reasons behind this. So I think part of it is, just as you described with this story, the clinical encounter and what's happening between patients and providers and implicit bias. But then there's also these bigger kind of more structural issues. So we know in public health, we talk a lot about the social determinants of health and the idea that where you work, live, play matters for your health, right? And so for people who may live in a neighborhood that has less access to trails and parks and safe areas for kids to play and things like that, that's going to impact health at some point. But we also need to be talking about the root causes of these issues. And for the disparities we're seeing with Black women, the root cause is often comes down to racism and structural racism in particular. So understanding that we are living and trying to survive in systems that were built to disadvantage people in our society based on race.
Right. So, Lisa, one of the terms that I encountered over and over again when I was doing research on this topic was this term weathering. Can you describe what that means and what the implication has been for African-American women?
Sure. So, you know, weathering has been described as sort of this this ongoing exposure that that people have to disadvantage, right? So, you know, over a lifetime, you know, exposures to like hazardous environment and poor housing conditions, poverty, you know, lack of opportunities to get education, and then being discriminated against, whether it's in school or whether it's at work or in law enforcement, all of those things sort of compounded are thought to actually wear upon the body, right, and to result in physical manifestations of stress that actually contribute to, like, illness. So that's what the weathering hypothesis is about. It's like these ongoing stressors that sort of build upon one another and then lead to, like, biological problems, you know, problems with metabolism, problems with cell damage that actually contribute to diseases like heart disease, diabetes, cancer, and just an aging, a premature aging.
Right. So going back to what you said, Rachel, I thought this was really interesting. When we're talking about why one woman might have a healthcare issue, we also have to look at where they grew up, what their surroundings were like. What do we know about environmental racism and how that affects women in particular, but also anyone who's living in a particular community?
Right. Well, first I would say that, you know, one of the kind of primary findings that public health researchers talk about is the fact that residential segregation is a key marker of health disparities, and particularly for Black communities. And you can't talk about residential segregation without talking about environmental racism and the fact that there's plenty of, even here in the Twin Cities, there are areas where they're more impacted by perhaps the garbage incinerator and the way the winds are blowing and the way that those communities have been built and situated and the decisions that have been made on a policy level to contribute to disadvantage in that way. And so we, you know, when we talk about why, you know, how this is such a complex issue, that's exactly why. Because, you know, you're thinking about the environment, you're thinking about the healthcare system, healthcare delivery, providers, employment, you know, all of these different factors that all contribute to and are going to contribute to where someone might be able to live and if they're able to afford to buy a home in a certain type of neighborhood.
Where do you even begin, right?
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to hear from our audience. I want to know about your experience as a Black woman in the healthcare system. Do you feel like you experienced racism? How did you deal with a difficult situation with the doctor or in the hospital? You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or tweet your experiences to me at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. So here's another really interesting point that writer Erica Stalling made in the article I mentioned earlier, and it was about social networks. She described her experience seeking a doctor to do the mastectomy like this. She was asking friends. She was asking fellow doctors. She was asking family members who had connections to doctors for referrals. And she found a really great doctor, and she was happy with the actual surgery the recovery period, not so much. She said that was in stark contrast to experiences she had read about among other Black women on breast cancer support pages who said they didn't know where to go or where to start. So, Lisa, I want to ask you, how important do you think social networks are for anyone seeking health care? And are there particular barriers that African-American women might face that white women, for instance, might not?
Definitely. So what I'll say is that social networks are incredibly important for health, for anyone's health. You know, when you think about it, you know, who you know and who you work with, who you live near, who you go to school with, those are people that actually, like, provide information for you. They introduce you to other people. They let you know where to find out things you need to know. And that always is something that leads to advantage. You know, you, when you think about, you know, being told about a job opportunity or somebody making a phone call on your behalf to introduce you to someone, all of those things, you know, give us advantages that we wouldn't have if we didn't know someone, right? And so, you know, I think what we see is that a lot of African-American women, because of the history of disadvantage for African-Americans in this country, many of them don't have the same contacts. They don't have friends who are doctors. You know, they don't have relatives who are doing research on cancer, for example. Like the writer of the article, she was an attorney, and she had a friend who, you know, whose husband was a cancer researcher. So, you know, those are the situations that actually, you know, advantage certain people over others. And, you know, historically, African Americans have not had those same sorts of connections and opportunities. And so I think that, you know, the story really laid it out well, is that this particular writer actually had a lot of advantages and was able to get to the best doctors and to get excellent care. But ironically, even having gone through all of that and having used her social networks, she still experienced, you know, poor care because of issues going on within the healthcare system.
Right. Rachel, go ahead.
And I would just also add to what Lisa said in that, you know, with respect to social networks, it signals who's in your in-group. And, you know, the people that we surround ourselves with are often people that are like us and have the same types of jobs or might be in the same kind of socioeconomic category that we're in. And that signals that we're alike in some way. And that, you know, the social psychology literature would suggest that that actually triggers kind of a level of empathy that perhaps you might not have for someone who is very, very different. So, you know, social networks play an important role in a lot of different ways in this story.
Sure. So I want to detour a little bit to read a call from Jessie in Milwaukee. She said, I wonder whether your guests have any knowledge about how you could assist Black women and other women of color in preventing diabetes. She called and said that studies have shown that diabetes is common in these communities and it gets more complicated once women get pregnant. And we're going to talk about pregnancy in a few minutes here. Rachel, do you have any suggestions on that?
So I think that's an excellent question. And it's one of the many kind of, you know, chronic health issues facing a lot of folks in the African-American community, as well as other communities. You know, and I think we tend to focus a little bit too much, in my opinion, on behavior, right, and changing someone's behavior, and need to do a better job of thinking more broadly around kind of issues of access, and not access to healthcare systems, but access to healthy food and vegetables. So are there the right types of grocery stores with produce in people's neighborhoods? And is it at a price that is affordable? And are we having conversations, our providers, our clinicians are able to have conversations about that? And also, are clinicians able to have conversations that are culturally centered and really understanding the lived experience of women and people who are most impacted by these disparities.
Right. So Rachel and Lisa, we'll get you on this as well. But one area where these disparities are really apparent is in childbirth, pregnancy. And there's been some excellent reporting on this topic in the last year or so. Rachel, what does the research tell us about why it is so dangerous for Black women to be pregnant?
Yeah, I think the research is still growing. You know, it's definitely been a hot topic over the past year or two. And again, it's a complex issue. It's multifactorial. You know, there's a lot of discussion around what's going on here. I think the primary focus right now is on racism as a risk factor for maternal mortality, maternal morbidity, and also infant mortality. And understanding, you know, as Lisa described, the weathering hypothesis and how the cumulative disadvantage over years is impacting women. So the initial study around weathering showed that younger Black women or Black teens actually had better birth outcomes than Black women who were older because they'd had less time to become, you know, quote unquote, weathered. And so, you know, thinking about structural racism and racism as a root cause to a lot of these issues is kind of at the forefront of the research right now.
So I want to take a call from Osman in St. Paul. Osman, you're on the line. What's your comment or question?
Yes, I just would like to make a comment. You know, I'm a dad, and you know, just one time I went with my wife, you know, for delivery, and we went to the hospital, and she was open like 8, you know, and I was hoping that we'll get a natural delivery, because surgery, you know, is a major surgery, and sometimes it might cause a lot of you know, health complications in long term, and you know, she was open for 8, and they were preparing for, you know, natural delivery, and what happened was, you know, because of we initially refused to have the epidural because my wife had before 2 of the epidurals and she was having a, you know, back pain, and we said, you know what, maybe this time we will not have it, and because we didn't take the epidural, she was feeling a lot of pain, and you know, they came and they, you know, some of them used the normal you know, emotional blackmailing sentence that say, you know, the baby is under stress, the, you know, the oxygen is you know, falling, the baby may be in a funny position, you need to go for a C-section, things like that. And she was open for 8. And, you know, I encountered those kind of situations before. So I said, no, she doesn't need it. And after some time, they said, you know what, she will go. And since my wife was in pain, they succeeded to persuade her to go for a C-section,
yeah.
And I was saying she doesn't need it. And then, and I told them, you know, I read about the C-sections and its problems, and that two most prestigious medical institutions in the country say that C-sections happen, 50% of the C-sections happen not because of the interest of the patient, but for some other reason. So
sure.
I understand that it's good for when you talk about the medical insurance for the, you know, for the hospital.
Osman, I think you're making an excellent point here, and I really want our guests to weigh in. I think what I hear you saying is that in your experience with your wife, you ended up having a procedure that the two of you were not necessarily on board with. And this is something we hear, you know, commonly among many women who are pregnant. Lisa, can you talk a little bit about this consent issue? I mean, how often are you encountering African-American women who feel like they are given a procedure or are not listened to in the hospital room, right, whether it's in birth or for something else?
Right, right. So here's a concern. You know, we have the data that show that, you know, oftentimes African-American women are getting poor health care, right? And, we know that in many cases that the C-section rate is higher than it should be for, you know. So in some cases, we find out that African-American women are getting less of something that's good, and sometimes we find out that the disparity is actually what we call a hyper disparity, that people are getting more of something that is higher risk. And so, you know, people in the community know about this, and so that raises their level of mistrust in doctors and in healthcare, and, you know, reasonably so. And then I think what the issue is that sometimes health professionals are not prepared to deal with that. You know, so what they, you know, what we need to do is to prepare doctors and health professionals to be more equipped to address issues of concern like this. You know, why people might be concerned that they're having a procedure they don't need, and why they might not be fully trusting of the doctor's decision. And be sensitive to that issue, and then also be clear in explaining, like, what are the risks, what are the benefits, and what is going into that decision. So in this particular situation, you know, we don't know. Maybe it was a situation in which, you know, the baby was in distress and the surgery was, you know, indicated, but, you know, for good reasons, you know, people of color have become suspicious about, you know, such treatments. And so I think you're just raising the point of, you know, how important it is, and Rachel talked about this before, about us training health professionals in how to communicate more appropriately, how to be more culturally sensitive, basically how to engender more trust in people who are different from them, you know. And so, you know, we've done lots of research on this and on why, you know, African-American women and men might be feeling less respected, you know. Yeah. And it's because physicians overall tend to dominate conversations when talking to African-American patients. You know, we've done studies where it shows doctors just talk. They don't allow African-American patients to ask as many questions. They don't sound as friendly or interested. You know, that's what our studies have shown. And that's something that can be rectified because, you know, a lot of it is not being done intentionally.
So we have another caller. We have Simone in Minneapolis. Simone, what's your question?
I just was interested in the question of the guests are pointing out these large disparities in pregnancy outcomes for Black women. And I just was wondering whether some of that, they were focusing on racism and noting that the younger women were having less bad outcomes than the older women. I was just wondering within even the economic levels between Black and white women, if they had adjusted for body mass index, because African-American women, even of the higher income and education levels, still have higher rates of obesity. And I was wondering whether that contributes to complications and negative health outcomes from their pregnancies, including higher rates of gestational diabetes. So if they could talk sure. about that a little bit, that'd be great.
Yeah. And I think, too, this goes back to this weathering question, right? You know, I mean, we're seeing higher rates of obesity because of this much broader structural racism that's going on, which could impact in pregnancies. But Rachel, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right, Kat. And also, you know, I would just add, based on the caller's question, that, you know, studies have controlled for all of those things, as well as, you know, risky behaviors like smoking and, you know, alcohol abuse. And the findings still persist that that Black race are, you know, Black women are at greater risk for poor outcomes. So even in models controlling for things like BMI and smoking and other risk factors, those findings.
Yeah, that is definitely true. I would agree with that. And the other thing that we've seen is that even after controlling for those factors, and even when if you look among women who are in the same socioeconomic group right. or bracket, you know, or have the same level of education or are within the same weight category, you still see the race differences.
Right.
So we're going to take a break here. But before we do that, I want to stay on this topic, moving into the second half hour. But I really want to hear from doctors. Are you a doctor practicing in a clinic or a hospital in a low-income area or a hospital that sees a lot of African-American patients? And I want to hear about what your experience has been with this issue, what you've seen. You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or tweet your experiences to me at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. I'm Catherine Richert, filling in for Carrie Miller, and this is NPR News. If you're just joining us, we've been talking about how exceptionally difficult it is for Black women to navigate the healthcare system. They're more likely to develop diseases like diabetes or high blood pressure, and they're more likely to face discrimination when they're trying to get care. My guests are Rachel Hardiman. She's an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota School of Public Health. And on the line with us is Dr. Lisa Cooper. She's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. And we want to hear from you. Have you experienced discrimination while getting treatment? How did you advocate for yourself? And if you're a doctor, I also want to hear from you and whether you've seen this in your practice. You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or tweet your experiences to me at Kat Richert. That's CatRichert. So while we were taking a break, we got an interesting question from Tia in Roseville. She said, there is this belief and portrayal within the Black community and throughout society of the strong, quote, strong Black woman. Is the strong Black woman a myth or reality? And could this portrayal bear consequences in health disparities? She said, they're tougher so they can endure more than others. Rachel, I'll start with you. What do you think of that question?
That's a really interesting and really important question. So first, I would say, you know, one of the things that I think is important to understand is particularly when we're talking about race and racism with respect to healthcare and health outcomes for Black women, is that we've built our history is built on the idea that Black women perhaps don't feel pain or are hardier. There's this notion of obstetrical hardiness that has been used in order to justify the testing and the perfecting of techniques, obstetrical and gynecological techniques on Black women. And I think that that myth and that kind of assumption, even if it's not explicit, it's underlying a lot of the belief systems and the biases that have been perpetuated in our healthcare system. And that they're bound to come out when Black women are accessing healthcare in a system that was built in that way. And so, you know, I think, and then, you know, you add on that the resilience that I think Black women have had to have in our society, just given, you know, the disparities and the inequities and kind of just what, you know, what we face. And so together, those two things kind of perpetuate this idea of the strong Black woman. And it's an important topic to have a conversation about and really to start to kind of dismantle what that is and what that means and how it's actually doing harm.
Right. So I want to talk a little bit about access, you know, going back to this concept of food deserts, for instance, or what your environment is actually like. One common thread in a lot of this research is that African-American typically have access only to hospitals that maybe have poor outcomes for their patients. I'll start with Lisa, actually, in this question. How critical is access to good care and also health insurance in this question? Does that factor into it?
It definitely factors into it. You know, Rachel mentioned that, you know, of course, this is like a very complex problem. And, you know, there are factors at several levels that contribute to poor health, you know. So obviously healthcare is not the only thing, but it is, you know, an important thing because that's where people actually have access to information. And that's where, you know, they can actually learn about how to prevent themselves from getting sick as well. So you can imagine that if you don't have health insurance, you're not going to be going in for your preventive checkups, and you're not going to be learning about ways to stay healthy. And then, you know, even worse, you know, if you don't have a regular physician or you don't have insurance, you know, you're going to delay getting help because you're concerned about, you know, the cost of it, and you're just concerned that you're not going to be treated well when you go in, and so you're going to delay it. And then when you do go in, you're going to be probably sicker than you would have been if you had gone in sooner. So it's definitely a contributing factor.
Sure. So I want to pivot a little bit because we have a caller on the line who has some observations and questions about mental health. There was a study published in The Lancet pretty recently that looked at the mental health of Black people when there had been an officer-involved shooting. The outcome was that it took a toll on their mental health. I think that's a really intuitive finding, but I also think it was something that was sort of important to put on paper. So we're going to take a call from Michaela in Minneapolis. Michaela, what are your observations and what are your questions for our guest?
Hi. So I am a mental health care provider in the Minneapolis area. And I just noticed when I get clients who have, you know, histories, maybe we're on mental health units, inpatient units, there's a disparity in the diagnoses. So a white person who committed crimes because they were addicted to drugs may not get a diagnosis of antisocial personality disorder, whereas a Black person will. And things like if they have hallucinations while they're on substances, a Black person may get a schizophrenia diagnosis, which doesn't really always fit, whereas a white person, they'll usually wait and see. So I just tend to see more patients and more care taken with white patients than with individuals of color. And these diagnoses are serious. They have a lot of impact on the treatment that we give and the medications that they're given, and they have a stigma attached to them.
Rachel, go ahead.
Yeah, I think that's a really, you know, thank you for sharing your experiences. So I am not, you know, a mental health expert, but you know, I think what you're describing certainly fits a profile of what we're seeing in other areas of the healthcare system as well. And it's an important, really critical area to continue to tease apart and understand what, you know, what's going on there, particularly, you know, to your point that this has long-term implications for how someone is able to get further treatment or even, you know, has implications for employment and things like that down the line.
Lisa, I want to ask you just more broadly, what do we know about discrimination and the toll it takes on mental health? What can we say about that?
Wow. Yeah.
Probably a lot.
We know quite a bit about that, actually. So I'll comment on that. And then I also wanted to add on to, I mean, to what Michaela brought up, is that I've actually observed the same phenomenon. And I think it's been documented in numerous studies as well, is that African-American patients are often misdiagnosed with mental health issues, or either like not recognized to have them, or are diagnosed with something that's like more severe with more negative consequences. So we've definitely seen that in a lot of our work. But to your point about the negative effects of discrimination on mental health, that's where we actually have the most information about the impact of discrimination on health, is in the area of mental health. And so, you know, it's been shown that, you know, people who report having been discriminated against in a number of different ways, you know, whether it's at school or at work or through the criminal justice system, are documented to have poor mental health in terms of like depression, anxiety, post-traumatic stress disorder, and then also substance use disorders, to develop those later in life when they've had early exposure to negative experiences of discrimination. Okay. So we have a huge amount of literature supporting that. And I thought that study that you mentioned earlier was a fascinating study that showed like that on a population level, like in areas where there were you know, more sort of negative experiences of African-American men being profiled by law enforcement, that the entire African-American population experienced poorer health in those areas of the country than in areas of the country where you didn't see that type of violence and discriminatory behavior.
Yeah, Rachel, go ahead.
I think actually Lisa just kind of summarized it really nicely. You know, I wanted to kind of circle back to the Lancet article and the fact that, you know, I think that that work is critical for understanding how kind of community level and even, you know, national level trauma can impact mental health. And we're actually looking at that. We currently have a study funded through the University of Minnesota to look at how living in a community that's experienced a high profile police violence event is impacting mental health for Black women in our communities here in the Twin Cities. And just knowing that it's not, you know, it doesn't have to be this individual level assault on someone to really have an impact on their health and well-being. Simply living and existing in a society that perhaps has not been supportive of who you are and your identity is can be incredibly harmful, is what we suspect is happening.
Yeah. So I want to go back to this question of African-American doctors being in the system. I think I read, you know, 5% of all doctors are African-American. I realize there's probably no silver bullet solution here, but how much do you think things would change if we were able to increase the number of African-American doctors, nurses, doulas, you know, birth coaches, whatever that might be in the system? Rachel, go ahead.
Sure. I think it would improve a lot of things. It's not the silver bullet. You know, as you just said, you know, it's not going to magically change things. You know, there are studies from, you know, 15, 20 years ago, even Thomas Leviste and others, who have found that Black patients in particular who receive care from a Black doctor report higher levels of satisfaction with that care. The work that I'm doing here in the Twin Cities, looking at a culturally centered model of maternity care in a freestanding Black-owned birth center, where, you know, what we're seeing is that they're, from the discussions with clients, is that the women are happier with the care that they've received, and they feel like they've had built this trusting relationship. So I think that there's something to be said for certainly diversifying our healthcare workforce in the broadest sense. But I think we also have to understand that these healthcare providers are being trained and educated in systems that have not quite dealt with the history of racism in our country, right? So if we haven't figured out a way to educate our providers, regardless of their racial background, in a way that that allows them to be comfortable discussing and understanding health inequity, structural racism, and things like that, we're going to produce a lot, you know, more of the same.
Right. So I really want to hear from doctors in our audience, especially doctors of color who maybe have lived this or experienced this. What are the challenges that you faced in getting your medical degree and entering the system as a doctor of color? And what have you seen in your practice? You can reach us at 651-227-6000 or tweet your experiences to me at @KatRichard. Lisa, I want you to weigh on in on this as well as both someone who has trained as a doctor, but also someone who is interacting with younger people in the field as well. What do you see as sort of the barrier to developing that pipeline?
Right. I have quite a few thoughts on this issue. I'm actually one of the people who did the first study that showed that when African-American patients see African-American doctors, that the visits are actually about 2.5 minutes longer on average than when they're seeing a different race doctor. That doesn't sound like a lot, but that 2.5 minutes actually translates to a much higher likelihood of remaining in care over time. We've seen that when visits are shorter and patients are not as involved in decision-making about their care, that they're more likely to not follow up with appointments. And we also know that that has a negative impact on health. So I think that it's incredibly important to diversify the physician workforce, not only because African-American doctors have been documented to, you know, provide more patient-centered care to African-American patients, but also because that will change sort of the culture of the profession as well. Now, you know, I agree that it's not a silver bullet and that we do need to do training. And so what are the barriers? I mean, I think we spend a lot of time focusing on technical aspects of care in medical school, you know, on providing didactic information about facts and things like that that people need to know. And, you know, there's been much less of a focus on sort of strengthening the interviewing skills and the interpersonal competence, and then also more knowledge about social determinants of health that exist outside of the typical biological and medical contributors. So, you know, what are the barriers have to do with the fact that we just have a lot of knowledge that needs to be imparted within those 4 years and also throughout the clinical training period. There's kind of like a little bit of resistance within the medical profession, thinking that, you know, these kinds of things are softer and it's like people should already know how to, like, talk to other people. Well, some of us are gifted communicators and, you know, others of us actually need to work more on that. And, you know, not only that, but, you know, it's like we could all actually benefit from learning how to interact with others who are different from us, you know, because naturally we're more comfortable with people who we think we share, we have more in common with. So I think those are the barriers. I think it's also going to take a while to develop, you know, people who can teach this material, who are comfortable with doing it, and who will also get, you know, rewarded for doing that. Frankly, in the academic system, there's a lot of focus on research. There's a lot of focus on generating big clinical programs, and there's a lot less reward for people who are excellent, like, trainers in, you know, areas like doctor-patient communication and cultural and structural competence. So the more we build that in to our programs and sort of build it in across the curriculum, it's not something that you just do for 2 weeks at the beginning of medical school, but it's something that gets brought up throughout your entire training. And we have faculty who actually model those behaviors and those values, I think we're going to see a shift.
Yeah. And I'm just thinking about that 2.5 minutes longer on average. I mean, I'm wondering if the people who participated felt like that extra time just made them feel valued and important. I mean, is that was there any sort of anecdotal feedback that you got as well?
Oh, yeah, certainly. I mean, we had people who commented that they actually liked their doctors. These were primary care physicians, and these were their patients who many of them had known for, you know, more than they'd known each other for more than 2 or 3 years and much longer in many cases. So these were people who said, you know, I like my doctor, and I think this doctor is great, and I trust them a lot. But we still saw a difference between the patients who saw white physicians and those who saw African-American physicians, which says to me that, you know, the situation could be even worse in other settings, you know.
Right. So we have a call coming in from Melinda in Andover, who makes some observations about education, educating Black women about what they should be asking for and what they should be thinking about. Melinda, what's your question?
Well, my question is that I am actually from West Africa, and we're immigrants in Minnesota, and we have a very large population here. But the problem is that we, due to sometimes language barriers and other that understanding what to really do to be able to get the health benefits. We're trusting these doctors to be able to provide us with education to be able to take care of ourselves. So on the line, where health is on the line for females, and how can we be able to go about getting the right questions and asking our doctors so that we can be able to live a healthy life?
Yeah, I'm curious to know how much of this is, pivots on education, just knowing what to ask for. Rachel, do you want to speak to that?
Sure. So, I think it's a both end. It's important for anyone, Black women in particular, but for anyone to be able to feel empowered and knowledgeable about their health and be able to ask the right questions. But I would also push back a little bit and say that I think, it's also the responsibility of our healthcare system to be able to take care of everyone and to offer everyone a high quality of care. There's groups like our organizations like the Black Mamas Matter Alliance, which is a national organization focused on the huge disparities in maternal mortality and morbidity for Black women, who are, thinking about ways to both influence policy and research, but also to, allow Black women to lead and take the lead and be centered in this work and really be thinking about how they can be the ones to affect change. And so, any ways that we can think about that more, I think, are really important to this issue.
Yeah.
Right. I'd like to add to that because I've done quite a bit of work on activating patients, and I actually am a West African immigrant myself, so I could relate pretty well to this patient, to this person on the phone talking about issues of language and culture. And that's another thing that happens is a lot of times physicians look at patients of African descent and assume that they all like the same, they all have the same background. Well, we're a very diverse group, and we have a lot of different cultural values. We come from a lot of different parts of the country and a lot of parts of the world. And so we don't all believe the same things, or we don't all want the same things. And so, it's really important to focus on individualized care. And I think one of the things we've done in our work is to coach patients in how to prepare for their visits with doctors and let them know that it's appropriate for them to ask questions about the treatments that they're being offered and why they're being offered those treatments and whether there are other alternatives, and that it's appropriate to call back. And if you're not sure you understood and not to feel that, that because a physician is like so highly trained that, that you don't actually have the right to ask questions. So we've done coaching programs, and we have tools that are available that patients can use. And so I would encourage the caller to visit our center's website. It's the Johns Hopkins Center for Health Equity, and the website is www.healthequityhub.com.
We have a little bit more time. I want to fit two more questions in here for our guests. And this is something I've been wondering about as I've been hearing you talk and doing this reading. It feels like there's this sort of fundamental issue of trust at play between the patient and the healthcare system as well. It seems to me that discrimination in the system would lead to that distrust. And there's certainly a history of that in the United States with Henrietta Lacks and the Tuskegee syphilis experiments. I could go on. But I'm wondering, it seems that we're sort of creating a situation for ourselves that goes backwards. If patients don't trust the system, and they are also more likely to have certain conditions, they're not going to use that system. They're not going to want to use that system. And that seems like we're going backwards. Rachel, what do you make of this distrust issue?
Yeah, the distrust issue is a huge one. And you cited some of the major stories, and those are the ones we know about, right? And so, and then you add in, particularly with respect to reproductive health, the history of eugenics in our country and, forced sterilization and all of those things, even when they're not explicitly in the minds of a patient as they're accessing the healthcare system, they're there, they're lingering, they're there in some way, shape, or form. And so, part of it, I think, is understanding that history, right? And, all of us, right? So clinicians, and I think it's everyone's responsibility to understand and kind of reconcile that history and know that it matters, that it really, that it had an impact. You know, there's studies that have talked about kind of the spillover effects of, for instance, the Tuskegee experiment and the fact that even those who weren't directly impacted by it, it still, you know, it impacts their communities in a lot of ways. And so being able to acknowledge that and, you know, have explicit conversations about it, you know, equipping providers even to be able to talk about with their patients the fact that you may be feeling this way. I get that. Here's how I'm going to, you know, help you work through that. And things like that are really, I think, critical.
Yeah. Lisa, what's your experience been with patients who simply don't trust the system for all of these reasons and aren't utilizing it in the way that might be useful to them?
Oh, yeah. I definitely have experienced this. I mean, I work at a community-based clinic that's not in East Baltimore, not far from Johns Hopkins Hospital. And I can tell you that most of my African-American patients there don't get their influenza vaccines. And, you know, and it's like, I can only assume that that's related to, you know, concerns about, you know, being experimented upon and, you know, not wanting to take treatments that they think, you know, maybe are not beneficial and that people are just sort of giving them. And so, you know, I think that it's a real issue. And I think that really, you know, the responsibility is lies with the healthcare system to demonstrate that we are trustworthy. You know, our leaders have to show that we actually do care about people from African-American communities, that we are committed to addressing their needs. We have to be transparent about the practices that we engage in. We have to show them information about how we care for patients of different groups. We have to present information to people in a way that they can understand and in a way where they can see themselves being represented in the information that we provide to them. So it's all of those things. You know, it's up to us as health professionals and as a health system to demonstrate that we are more trustworthy, you know.
And Lisa, do you have those specific conversation with a specific patient? And what do you say to them?
Yeah. Well, I say to them what, you know, it sounds like you're concerned, you know, or that you might be worried about something related to this treatment. Tell me more about that. And then, you know, I allow them to tell their story because I don't want to, you know, put words into their mouth. And then when they tell me those things, I say, well, you know, it sounds like a family member of yours may have had a negative experience. I'm sorry, you know, about that. And I just want to, you know, reassure you that I'm here working with you in your best interest. You know, I have your best interest at heart, and this is what I would recommend to my family member, you know. However, I respect your right to, you know, to decide what you'd like and what you wouldn't like. You know, but just to let them know that I'm still there for them and that I'm presenting them the information and this is why I think it's good and why I'm suggesting it and what I would recommend. But ultimately, it's up to them and it's based on their value system.
Yeah. Know? So before we sign off here, I really want to talk about solutions. And we've talked broad brush about training. We've talked about cultural competency. But I really want to hear about one or two interesting initiatives that you guys have observed in your work that you think is really effective. Rachel, I'm going to start with you.
Sure. You know, solutions are the hard part, right? But the exciting part of, you know, the work I get to do, I think, you know, and this is related to what Lisa was just describing around how she, you know, talks to her patients and interacts with them. To me, a lot of what she was describing is what I would call a culturally centered or a culturally focused model of care. And, you know, one of the things that we're currently looking at, we're still, you know, slowly building this evidence base. You know, we can't say for 100% for certain that this works, but with respect to pregnancy and prenatal care is, you know, a culturally centered or culturally focused model of care that allows the space for those conversations, right? And that really embraces who the person is, the community they live in, their lived experience, and allows the time for those types of discussions, I think is critical to this work and to really thinking about ways to transform the way that we are offering care.
Yeah, Lisa, quickly, I just want to hear from you as well. What are you seeing in your field?
Sure. Sure. Well, one of the things we're doing right now is we are actually working on this kind of training for nurses, nurse care managers who work with patients who have chronic disease and who are from underserved communities, and really training them in motivational interviewing skills and patient-centered interviewing skills, and then also having them work with community health workers. So these are people who come from the communities, who grew up there, who really understand what it's like to live in those communities where the patients are coming from, and who are actually able to go out to people's homes, help them deal with things that they're struggling with at home, you know, things like where to go shopping for healthy food, how to get transportation, you know, those kinds of things, really training community health workers and nurses to work together on teams.
Yep. Well, thank you guys so much. Our guests have been Rachel Hardiman. She's an assistant professor at the University of Minnesota of Public Health. And our second guest was Dr. Lisa Cooper. She's a professor at Johns Hopkins University. Thank you both. This is NPR News.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Kerri at KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.